Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has two causes on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Chrysler Corporation versus the Honorable Robert Blackman, judge, an original mandamus proceeding, and Robert J. Roundtree II, M.D. versus Penelope Hunsaker and John Hunsaker from Gregg County. In the first cause, the court has allotted 25 minutes for relator and respondent to present oral arguments, and in the second cause, 20 minutes for each side to present oral arguments. The relator and petitioner may reserve a certain amount of time for rebuttal argument by so advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of these arguments, and then we'll conclude the submissions before our lunch break. The counsel in the second cause are not required to remain in the courtroom, but we ask that you remain nearby so that we may proceed to your matter without delay. And these arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. If you desire to listen to a tape of these arguments, you may make application with the clerk of our court. The court is now ready to hear arguments from relator in Chrysler versus Blackman.
May it please the court, Mr. Josephson and Mr. Powers will present arguments for the petitioners. Mr. Josephson will open. Petitioners have reserved 6 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Richard Josephson and I am counsel for Chrysler Corporation in connection with this case. If I may begin at the beginning, this case involved an automobile accident in which the plaintiff was killed while driving a Chrysler automobile. The other driver of the other vehicle, it is agreed between the parties, was intoxicated. It has been admitted that his conduct was negligent and was approximate cause of the accident. He swerved on the wrong side of the road and crashed almost head-on into the plaintiff's vehicle at a speed which the parties generally agree a closing speed in excess of 90 miles an hour. Chrysler Corporation is before the court having had its defenses stricken and having had a default judgment entered against it, in spite of the facts that I just mentioned. In spite of the fact, as the record indicates, through sworn affidavits which are before this court, that Chrysler has spent, at this point, in excess of $300,000 trying to comply with various court orders on discovery. In spite of the fact that Chrysler has produced in excess of 100,000 documents made available for inspection by the plaintiffs, 200,000 documents in addition to the 100,000 produced, and in all probability faces the prospect, even if this is overturned, of additional requests and additional attempts at sanctions, unless this court issues an opinion which sets out substantive safeguards to give the trial court's guidance coming off its opinion in Transamerica and Braden. Taking Transamerica and Braden, let me see if I can go back and explain to the court what I think has happened in this case and why the requirements set out by this court in Transamerica and Braden, and again reiterated in November of 1991 in the Kopp case, were not followed in this case. On February 15th of 1991...
Before you proceed, is it clear that the sanction order made subject to this mandamus that the hearings all occurred prior to the court's issuance of the two cases, Transamerica versus Bowden and Braden versus Downey?
That is correct.
And in what way did you bring to the trial court's attention those two cases?
In...
At any time.
The order, Your Honor, entered on August 8th reflects that the court considered both Transamerica and Braden.
I'm familiar with the order, but my question is, in what way did you bring to the trial court's attention your arguments concerning Transamerica and Braden?
Our last hearing, I believe, was June 21st. I think Transamerica and Braden came out the 22nd. I can't, at this point, remember if copies of those opinions were sent to the court or not. My belief is they were not.
Did you move for reconsideration or bring to the trial court's attention up to the day the arguments that you're presenting to us concerning Transamerica and Braden?
Your Honor, we did not, and we did not for the following reasons. The order of August 8th was issued after approximately a two-minute hearing. Subsequently thereafter, Mr. Perry's firm prepared a five or six-page order reciting a litany of facts, none of which were reflected at the August 8th hearing. That order, however, did state in it that the court followed both Braden and Transamerica and applied its precepts in the way Chrysler Corporation's conduct was judged. Therefore, we felt that the court, having stated that it followed due process, which is clearly set out in Braden and Transamerica, having a trial setting upon us, the case was set for trial at that time in November, and
that
having...
That brings up another interesting question. As soon as you finish, how come you waited 40 days to seek mandamus?
If the court will go back, the court will see that we requested, and this is also part of the record, the court will see that we requested a copy of the August 8th hearing almost immediately after the August 8th hearing occurred. We didn't even get the record back from the August 8th hearing until the end of August. We filed our brief in September. Shortly thereafter, the Court of Appeals, without any order or anything else, allowed the party several weeks to brief the question, or a week to brief the question, and subsequently denied our writ of mandamus. We then appealed to the Texas Supreme Court, and at that particular point in time, it was approximately a week or a week and a half before the trial was actually set in the case, which was November 5th, and sometime in the latter part of October, this court issued a petition. This court granted leave for us to file our petition for writ of mandamus.
Did you get to see the order signed by Judge Blackmun of August the 8th? Was
no, we did not. In fact, I think that is brought up in the record. It was never shown to us. It was taken over to Judge Blackmun. It was signed, and then we received a copy of it in the mail later on. What basically happened here is the fact that we had a major hearing on February 15th. Essentially, the same evidence that was presented a number of times in this case was presented to Judge Dunham. Judge Dunham denied plaintiff's request for sanctions, denied a motion to strike pleadings, denied a request to enter monetary sanctions. Basically, there were about 20 or so allegations of misconduct on the part of Chrysler on February 15th. Judge Dunham ordered us to produce approximately, or make production in approximately six areas. He gave us until April 1st to comply. We filed a major production trying to comply with those six items on April 1st, and then Chrysler Corporation sought a motion for compliance, a hearing on our compliance on April. The first setting we could get was April 10th, and on April 10th, we appeared in court seeking a hearing on our request for a certification of our compliance with the court's order.
Let me back up to February to be sure we've got the record straight on what happened in February. At that time, were the plaintiffs seeking to strike your pleadings?
Yes, sir.
And the judge entered a sanction at that time that if you didn't comply by April 1st, it would be $7,500 a day as an alternative to that?
Actually, he denied the request for sanctions. He stated that he entered an order which had a prospective sanction if it was determined that there was not compliance as of April 1. That's, I believe, the way the order was phrased. But the first three paragraphs of the order denied plaintiff's motion for sanctions, denied plaintiff's request to strike the pleadings. If I might, Your Honor, point out that the plaintiffs have never filed a motion to compel in this case without asking for death penalty sanctions. They filed their first motion to compel back in 1989, had death penalty sanctions. So it was nothing new for them.
You went to the February 15th hearing. What they were trying to get was to strike your pleadings at that time.
That's correct.
And that's the only sanction that they were seeking. They did not recommend any lesser sanctions.
That's correct.
At that hearing, it was the judge's idea to go with the $7,500 a day if there was not compliance by April the 1st.
Yes, sir.
And in doing that, he did reflect in the hearing, did he not, that he felt he would certainly be warranted in entering sanctions at that time.
He reflected a number of things in comment. That was one of them.
And then at the April hearing, when you had your motion to certify that you had complied, you had a two-day hearing at that time concerning that and concerning their motion to strike your pleadings again.
No, incorrect. I'll explain.
Thank you.
At the same time, we sought compliance. The plaintiff had filed yet another request for production, the fourth discovery, on February 27th. Although we set our request to seek court compliance with Judge Dunham's order, in fact, the bulk of the hearing was taken up not with that, but with the fourth request for production, where I think the judge virtually denied virtually every objection that Chrysler filed to plaintiff's fourth request for production at that time. So that's the bulk of what was done. We were allowed some time, but not very much time, to certify our compliance. What happened then was that there was another hearing then set on April 25th, and I think that may be what the court had reference to. At that hearing, we put on evidence to try to show our compliance with the order, but at the same time, again, pointing out, plaintiff set yet another motion to strike our pleadings on April 25th, claiming this time that not only had we failed to comply with other orders, but we failed to comply with Judge Dunham's order, made virtually the same arguments that he had made on February 15th before Judge Dunham, where Judge Dunham didn't strike the pleadings. The next event in the case was the letter by Judge Blackmun on May 11th, after this April 25th hearing. In the letter of May 11th, Judge Blackmun wrote the parties and said he wanted the parties to comment on an appropriate sanction because he felt that there was some abuse of discovery. He never specified what it was. But most important, he said the following two things. Whatever this sanction that was never set out was, it wasn't severe enough to warrant case-ending sanctions, such as striking pleadings. That was number one. And number two, the parties need not even brief the question of death penalty sanctions because he wasn't interested in that. So what happened was I wrote a letter to the court, and I stated in my letter of May 11th, I don't think we violated, that Chrysler violated any court order, but since the court has asked us for potential sanctions, I suggested the court could do one of two things. They could either have a hearing, and if they felt that there was an abuse of discovery, they could award reasonable attorney's fees to the plaintiffs as sanction number one. By this time, our copying costs for plaintiff's discovery was well in excess of $10,000. I don't remember what it was at the time. I also suggested that they could tax those costs against us. So I gave the court two options. Mr. Perry, on the other hand, in his request to the court, asked either for Judge Dunham's fine to be entered or to prohibit our experts from offering certain testimony at the time of trial. So basically,
reiterated his feeling that the death penalty was an appropriate sanction.
He did in the letter, but if the court will look at the order that he proposed that he sent to Judge Blackmun, it doesn't say anything about death penalty sanctions. It proposes experts that Chrysler be limited in what its experts could say. They couldn't testify about any documents that they hadn't produced to the plaintiffs, or number two, that the fine that the judge set out be that an order be entered finding we were not in compliance with Judge Dunham's order, which I think is significant because the plaintiffs themselves concede by that there was no automatic triggering of Judge Dunham's order, that a court had to find at some point in time that we were not in compliance with Judge Dunham's order because we said we were, and we presented evidence on it. So as things stood on May 11th, they were essentially conceding that Judge Dunham's order on compliance, that the court had to take some affirmative step. This goes then to what I consider an extremely significant hearing, the last major hearing in this case before the August 8th hearing, and that is the hearing that was held on June 21st. And at the June 21st hearing, there are a number of interesting statements made by the judge. The most interesting statement, and I think the most pertinent for our discussion, is found after the judge goes through a process of discussing where the parties have come. At the very end of the hearing, he says, and I quote, and this is Exhibit 40 in our exhibits, and it's on page 114, one of you suggested some attorney's fees and letting these fellas travel up somewhere. That was my suggestion. I thought that was probably the most reasonable suggestion. The problem is I'm going to have a hearing on attorney's fees, and I really don't want to do that. I would like to resolve that matter because I want to get the case to trial and try it. And I think probably a problem has been there are two or three judges involved in this case. I don't know if the outcome would be any less of a mess now, but I don't like for my cases to be messy for pretrial. This one is. We are going to get this resolved. We are going to go to trial in this case, if not in November, pretty damn quick. That was essentially the judge's last expression. So when Judge Doggett asked me, did I then send him the opinion on Transamerican Braden, I can honestly tell the court I don't recall doing it, but I certainly did not feel, given his letter of May 11th, that not even to brief the question of death penalty sanctions, but to propose other alternatives, and number two, the comments made by the court in the last thing the court said on June 21st, that my client was facing the prospect of death penalty sanctions. Let me point out that also at that hearing, and this is extremely important because there are a number of findings that appear in this fourth discovery, which are, I think, I'm sorry, in the order of August 8th, which granted case-ending sanctions, which I think are extremely important given this background. Number one, the August 8th order reflects that this court had followed Braden, that this court, the trial court, had previously entered an order awarding lesser sanctions, but that order had been violated. The hallmark of Braden was, before you go to the death penalty, you have to enter lesser sanctions and then show that there has been a flagrant and bad faith violation of those lesser sanctions before you even consider the question of death penalty sanctions. This order of August 8th reflected that death penalty sanctions, that lesser sanctions had in fact been entered, referring again to Judge Dunham's order. In fact, there isn't a single shred of paper in this record indicating any order ever awarding lesser sanctions as to Chrysler Corporation. It cannot be found. It does not exist. There was no automatic triggering mechanism. In fact, the June 21st order, Judge Blackmun himself noted in the record, Mr. Watts wants me to impose a $200,000 sanction. And that's when he went into the discussion about the reasonableness of the attorney's fees. Obviously, no sanction had been imposed as of June 21st, yet it appears in the August 8th order as having been imposed.
Second of all, there is an imaginary hearing reflected in the August 8th order, which never took place. There is an order that reflects that a hearing was held on plaintiff's fourth request for production. This is how they tried to meet the national hockey test, showing that we acted in bad faith and flagrantly violated a court order after lesser sanctions had been imposed. They claim in this order, and I say they because it was really in practicality not drafted by the court, they claim in that order that we did not comply with the fourth request for production. That order is signed by the court. There never was a motion to compel on the fourth request for production. Our due date on the fourth request for production was only July 31, 7 or 8 days prior to this hearing on August 8th. There never was a hearing. There never was notice. There never was anything. Yet that order reflects that on that day, we violated the fourth request for production.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. David Perry will present arguments for the respondents.
May it please the court. The issue before the court is whether the trial court abused its discretion under the procedures reiterated 2 weeks ago in Walker versus Packard in light of the legal standards that are set down in Transamerican and in Braden, and based on the fact findings that were made by the trial court. In the briefs and in the arguments, counsel largely ignored the fact findings made by the trial court, even though this court has reiterated again in Walker versus Packard that it is the function of the trial court to make the fact findings in these kinds of issues.
It's been suggested that Transamerican proposed a different standard of review, that of de novo review of death knell sanctions. Do you disagree with that?
I think that Transamerican sets out the legal standard that the court is required to apply under the procedure that was reiterated in Walker versus Packard, so that the trial court, presumably under Walker versus Packard and all of the earlier cases, continues to have the fact-finding function that trial courts have under our system, but that the legal standard that the court has to apply to the facts that are found would be the standards that are set forth in Transamerican and Braden. This court has not yet announced, as I read the cases, any departure from that procedure. The facts that were found by the trial court, and this is a copy of the court order, which is in Appendix 1 of the brief and is under the first tab of the notebook that we presented. The facts that were found by the trial court are not of some isolated violation by Chrysler. They are facts finding long-standing, continual, repeated, and willful abuse of the discovery process. Transamerican rejected the requirement that trial courts go into detail on specific fact findings, but this order nevertheless follows the recommendation but not the requirement of Transamerican and goes into great detail setting out the specific violations over and over again that Chrysler committed in the course of this proceeding. And what we see is that there is not one or two isolated instances, but a pattern of conduct, a pattern of conduct that is not unique to this case, but a pattern of conduct that, in fact, under the evidence, Chrysler was engaging in, not only in this case, but in other cases pending in other jurisdictions around the nation. The relator's brief argues that there is some sort of sanctions tort agenda on the part of the respondents here. But this dispute begins with an agreed order where Chrysler, we were trying to enforce what Chrysler agreed they should produce to us, not some larger or broader order that had been entered. We start out with an agreed order, and what we find is not just on one subject, but on many subjects. On the subject of crash tests, the crash test reports, the technical data generated by the crash test, the crash test index, the meeting minutes, the design drawings, similar lawsuits, organizational charts and directories, on all of these kinds of many, many issues that are routinely involved in a case of this nature, we find the pattern that is revealed where, first of all, in the agreed order, and this is just a copy of the part that deals with the crash test index. Chrysler agrees to produce the crash test index. And the standard pattern is that then they produce a little bit, and they produced to us two pages, crash test index. And we could tell from our knowledge of these kind of cases and from other documents that that was not complete. They also produced some crash tests. And there was a long series of correspondence and letters and phone calls and exchanges. And we come up to getting ready for Judge Dunham's hearing, and they produce a little bit more, a little longer list of crash tests. And then when we get into getting ready for the hearing before Judge Dunham, we get to the second part of the pattern, which is they deny that it exists. And they filed a pleading in the trial court that said Chrysler does not maintain a master crash list index as requested by the plaintiffs, and we submitted at a later time, it's in the record, evidence that they said the same thing to other courts, in Illinois in particular, about the same time denying the existence of the crash index when in fact Chrysler's counsel probably didn't know this in this case, Chrysler's trial counsel, but clearly Chrysler itself knew and had to know that it existed. They also, Chrysler's counsel, made the same representation orally to the court, undoubtedly relying on what his client had told him.
Mr. Perry, there's a statement in one of the briefs that this crash test master list had been destroyed 10 years earlier or something.
What we finally found, ultimately, the court ordered them to produce an electronic copy of this of the database that this thing consists of. And ultimately they did that, and eventually we found that the printout of the in-body crash test that they should have given us at the beginning is this size. Now what happened though when they gave it to us finally is that they had destroyed and erased from the copy they gave to us specific data on many, many important crash tests. So, in truth, the item existed. This is the volume of what they should have given us in June of 1990, and actually, we ultimately got it, I think, just before. We're not able to read it. We didn't get the code books until actually after the default judgment.
There's an argument made that what you're holding up, presumably, it has something to do with airbag test that had nothing to do with the master list crash index. At least that's the argument as I understand it.
Chrysler at one point tried to justify not giving us some things, but not this, on the ground that they were airbag matters and were not related to this case. That argument was never made with regard to the crash test index. The crash test index, they argued that it didn't exist. Then later on, when they were caught, they argued that they couldn't give it to us because the software was owned by some other company. And then later on, they finally gave us the tape, but they wouldn't give us the code books on how to read the tapes. It was at that point that the default was entered. We got some of the code books later. We got some other code books actually after this case was set for oral argument. There was never an argument made as to why they should not have given us the crash test index of all of the in-body crash tests along the airbag line. That was an argument that was made on some other issue. And one of the patterns of this case is that when Chrysler would get caught, they would always have some sort of excuse that did not necessarily relate back to earlier orders. One of the reasons I bring up the crash list index is that the beginning point is the agreed order, which makes it so clear that they had agreed to produce it to us. Then they denied that it existed. Then they did produce it. And I think it was that pattern of events that ultimately drove the trial court to the belief that there was no alternative except to strike the pleadings.
Why is that?
For this reason, where we ultimately got to is that we cannot get the crucial evidence that is needed to try the case.
Why couldn't the trial court just as readily have concluded that an award of attorney's fees at a substantial amount, if that's what was involved in the production of this, would sanction the abuse if there was one by Chrysler?
I think because over and over and over again, Chrysler had been warned, Chrysler had been told that sanctions are under consideration, Chrysler had been told that default is still under consideration, and Chrysler had solidified its position on regard to important stuff like crash tests by claiming we can't give them to you, now they're destroyed. And what we ultimately got down to, there are, and the claim is made in the brief, which is absolutely not true, that everything has now been produced to us. The fact is, there are 63 major frontal in-body crash tests that are part of the critical evidence of the case that has never been produced, that Chrysler now says they can't produce because they say they're destroyed. When they produced the crash test index to us, they produced it with erasures of large amounts of the critical data out of the index, so that with regard to many, many crash tests, it is of essentially a little, if any, value.
Transamerican says that before case ending or death penalty sanctions are imposed, the refusal to comply with discovery should rise to the level that it gives rise to a presumption or inference that can be drawn from it that the case, that there's no defense to the case, or if it were
the plaintiff's defense lacks merit.
Or if it were the claim or defense lacks merit. How can the refusal, or assuming it's a refusal, to produce crash test index indicate that Chrysler has no defense to a liability claim when two vehicles ran together at a combined speed of 90 miles an hour?
Oh, because the crash tests are critical to this kind of case. When two cars come together, if they're both going 45 miles an hour, it gives you a 90 mile an hour closing speed, which Chrysler claims, although no expert has yet said that in this case. Most cars today are built and ought to be built to where the occupants will not be fatally injured in a crash equivalent to what is called a 35-mile crash into a fixed barrier, which is equivalent to a far greater actual energy impact than what happened in this case. In this case, we had what is called a delta V, stopping force on our vehicle of about 30 to 35 miles an hour. The two vehicles hit. They did not hit directly head on. Our vehicle was larger than the other one, and by the time you apply the engineering, we have a delta V of about 30 to 35 miles an hour on our vehicle, which means that our client, who's fully belted and so forth, ought to live. Now, the performance of Chrysler's vehicle is attested to by their crash tests that they run in the design process. It is the absence of those, and the absence of that is crucial evidence as to what they knew about the performance of the vehicle.
And I'm assuming that. But it seems just sort of intuitive that if two vehicles run together at a closing speed of 90 miles an hour, that somebody may die. So at least it's not so obvious that somebody won't die, that the failure to produce evidence gives rise to a presumption that they're just stalling because they're going to lose this lawsuit.
There's no question that in a severe impact, somebody may get killed. The facts that we have in this case is that a properly designed vehicle in a collision of this type, you can expect the person in the position of our driver to live. And the reason our driver didn't live is that Chrysler's vehicle had a steering column which came rearward into the passenger compartment greater than what is allowed by law and crushed his chest. It's the primary basis of our case. Now, the crash tests show Chrysler's knowledge of that. The crash tests also can be expected to show alternate designs that Chrysler should have pursued that would have alleviated that problem.
Is any of this in the index? That
The crash tests themselves and the crash test index are probably the two most major things that we don't have. The crash tests themselves, and then there's much data that shows the results of the crash test in the index. The index will list, for example, whether there is a failure with regard to the way the front end collapses, with regard to the steering column intrusion, with regard to many other things. By the time we got the crash test index, that data had been erased from the records that pertain to many, many of the crash tests. And at the same time, Chrysler does not produce and now claims that they have destroyed, shredded, 63 major crash tests that occurred. We know when they occurred from the index, but we don't know what happened to them.
And when was that?
They claim these crash tests occurred in the early development stage of the vehicle, which makes them very crucial. Chrysler claims...
What period of time, Jeff?
These are crash tests that were done. This is a 1984 model vehicle, but it is a cycle that begins with a 1978 model year. And these are crash tests that are done in basically 1977, some in 1978, during the early life of this cycle of vehicle, which is the crucial time when the important kind of things ought to be.
And you contend you don't have those tests yet?
There's no question that we do not have those. There are 63 frontal in-body crash tests that we absolutely do not have. And one of the questions that we all need to have in mind for Chrysler is, suppose this case was sent back to the trial court to look at lesser sanctions and to enter lesser sanctions. Are we going to get those crash tests? Are we going to get a copy of the crash test index that does not have all this material erased?
Were those crash tests produced in any other courts around the country, the ones that you're still requesting?
We have not been able to find those particular crash tests at this point anywhere. We have looked and we cannot find them. At this point on the crash tests, we are stuck in the particular phase of Chrysler's pattern where they deny the existence of it. Now, their pattern is that if we catch them, they'll produce them. But at this point, we're stuck in the phase where they deny the existence of them, and I think what has happened is this has happened so often over and over again, the trial court no longer believe their denial that they exist. Yes,
about another aspect of this. Let's assume, solely for purposes of argument, that you're correct about that, and that there is good support in the record for the trial court's conclusion about the continual and willful abuse. You've had something like, what, 4 or 5 days, full days of hearings over sanctions and over what the level of Chrysler's compliance or noncompliance before this order was entered, haven't you?
Yes, sir.
At those earlier hearings, when Chrysler and I guess the plaintiffs also went into court for a diagnosis or prognosis about what was going to happen in this case, it would appear that the trial court was telling Chrysler that it didn't have a fatal disease And then the next thing that Chrysler finds out in August is that it gets an obituary notice. And under Transamerica, even if you show the continual abuse, isn't there a requirement that they have more complete notice about the danger of essentially of being denied the opportunity to cover his future claim?
I think Chrysler got complete and full notice, and I think the important thing to look at, and this is tab 3 in your notebooks and appendix 3 in the brief, and this is a copy of Judge Blackman's May the 10th letter. There was no question before May the 10th that we were trying to get a default judgment. Chrysler understood that. The judge understood that. Everybody understood it. The judge wrote him and said it was his opinion that abuse occurred so we could all see that some sanctions are coming. He says he feels that the sanction strike of pleading is too severe. He says he has not had the chance to consider other sanctions other than what I'm asking for, which we all understand is primarily a default. And then he asked everybody to write him briefing other sanctions. He does not say, contrary to Chrysler's statements, that he's no longer interested in the default, but he says he wants to consider other things. At this point, we ask him to go back and revisit the default issue, and we submit additional evidence, and we continue from time to time to send the court additional evidence about the new things that Chrysler has found to be doing wrong. We send him some in response to this. We sent him others in that we filed the morning of August the 8th before the hearing where we documented their failure to comply with the fourth discovery. So what we see is that Chrysler had complete notice of what was going to happen, or what might happen, and they had every opportunity to respond to it.
Despite that notice, Mr. Perry, is it fair to say, however, that the relators are correct when they say that no sanction against Chrysler had been imposed or paid, a lesser sanction?
No, sir. I don't believe so in this sense. We can all read Judge Dunham's order and we can see what it did. The prior courts, National Hockey League, Insurance Company of Ireland, Hammond Packing, all the U.S. Supreme Court cases, virtually all courts, consider that the entry of an enforcement order is equivalent to the kind of warning or lesser sanction that you have to have before you go to the stronger sanction. And what we have here is that Judge Dunham entered an order which he specifically said was a Rule 215 order, which he specifically said was a sanctions order.
So if there's a discovery dispute, legitimate dispute between the parties as to what ought to be produced, that the fact that there is an order ordering production of some documents constitutes a lesser sanction order as contemplated by Transamerica. Is that your contention? Or
I don't think that the kind of agreed order that we started out with would be in that context. But when you go and you have a hearing and the court finds, as Judge Dunham did, Chrysler has done wrong, I'm not going to strike their pleadings, I'm not going to have monetary sanctions, I think they've done wrong, I'm going to enter a Rule 215 order that requires a lot of specific things, I think that, under National Hockey League in Ireland and Hammond Packing Company, gets you the equivalent. The importance of the lesser sanctions is that you don't have somebody who is trigger-happy. You don't do this like a bolt out of the blue. You give people a warning. And this functions in that same way. It has the equivalent in terms of a warning of a lesser sanction. And then in this case, Judge Blackman specifically, repeatedly, additionally discussed and talked about and told Chrysler that he was further considering lesser sanctions later on. Did he have to go to the default, or would lesser sanctions do the trick?
Let's say Chrysler had interposed a claim of privilege to some of these documents based on trade secrets or something, hypothetically. The fact that you have to go to court on a motion to compel and on their objections based on that privilege, and the trial court enters an order disposing of that matter based on the good faith contentions of both parties, does that constitute the kind of prior order contemplated by Transamerica, or is it something different?
I would not think so. That's not what happened in this case. I would assume that if you simply go to court to get a ruling on privilege matters, you know, somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose. That does not, to me, rise to the level of sanctions order. To me, in order to get to a sanctions order, you have a hearing on sanctions, you have a claim that somebody has been abusive, you have what Judge Dunham found, that there has been actual abuse, and the judge says, I'm going to enter an order under Rule 215. I don't think that you would call it a sanctions order when it's simply a ruling on a good faith dispute between the parties. That's very different from what we had here.
What about the inclusion in these findings of the fourth discovery request, which Chrysler says was not even due, as I understand it?
No, their deadline had passed. We had not had an oral hearing on that subject, but the morning that the judge held his two-minute announcement hearing, we didn't know what was going to happen at that hearing, and we filed our latest affidavit documenting what they had done wrong at that time before the hearing. And when we drafted the order, we did include in the draft, because I think the court's entitled to consider everything in the record, we included in the draft a finding on that, which by the time the judge read and signed the order, I presume that he was aware of the record, as we are entitled to presume that he was aware of the record, and that's what the, there's no dispute that what had happened was. Chrysler had been ordered to produce the electronic index together with all of the code books. They produced the index, they didn't produce the code books, and we couldn't get into it at that point in time.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is William Powers. I represent the AMICI in this case, the Product Liability Advisory Council, and the Motor Vehicle Manufacturers Association. I want to make a very brief point and leave the rest of the rebuttal to Mr. Josephson. In Transamerica, this court put substantive limits on case-ending sanctions. In our brief, we urge the court and would like to respectfully re-urge the court to consider, along with those substantive limitations on case-ending sanctions, procedural limitations on case-ending sanctions. And we've gone over those in detail in our brief, and we commend those to the court. The need for case-ending, for procedural safeguards before there are case-ending sanctions, I couldn't put it more eloquently than Justice Doggett did as to why this case is a good vehicle to show the need for procedural safeguards. Chrysler thought that it had a motion for hearing on its motion for partial summary judgment. 2 days before that, it was told this would be a sanctions hearing. It was not told death penalty sanctions would be considered. In fact, the letters from the court had assured the parties that death penalty sanctions were not going to be used. So that, in a sense, there was an assurance that there was not a fatal disease here. And at a three-minute hearing, no evidence, the case is virtually over. Chrysler's given an obituary. Surely Chrysler deserves more procedural safeguard than that before such a drastic sanction could be given. I'd like to
any
have
questions?
The
rest.
Thank you.
Let me see if I can make a few points. I want to deal just with one thing. I don't mean to get sidetracked, but I think it's very important. What the court heard during counsel's argument was another litany about crash tests. This crash test index, just so everyone understands, we produced a sworn affidavit on April 1 in conformance with Judge Dunham's order, which, and a computer printout, which said, Chrysler has a five-year document retention policy for crash tests. This is a list of crash tests that have been destroyed, that our computer shows has been destroyed. And there was a computer printout of probably in excess of 100 crash tests. This index that was produced
didn't
was dated.
Did you know all of that at the time you agreed to produce it?
Pardon, Your Honor?
Didn't you know all of this at the time you agreed to produce it?
No, Your Honor. This was, in fact, what this was in response to Judge Dunham's order, he ordered us to go back and see what tests were specifically destroyed and what tests weren't destroyed.
My point is, how can you agree to produce something if you didn't, that you
because the order
does not exist.
We said we would produce everything that existed, and I think that's the key word. We told Mr. Perry we had produced what existed. This computer printout, instead of showing Chrysler to be bad, actually bore out that a 1983 document, long before this accident had ever occurred, long before this suit had ever been filed, that these crash tests had been destroyed. In conformance, not with some...
There were no lawsuits that had asked for crashworthiness tests on these documents by 1981, 82, or 83, whenever they were destroyed in your regular program.
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. I don't know that there were embody cases or what requests for discovery had been made prior to that. I know that we produced a document retention policy.
Well, is it your position that you could have a lawsuit pending to ask for these tests and you have to save those and produce them in that case, but that the underlying document from which you made a copy for lawsuit A could be destroyed and then it's gone?
No, I know that not to be the case because basically we found documents that had not been destroyed, that were within the document retention period, that were still present, and we produced those. There are numerous examples of our production.
Why would some be saved if you have a regular document destruction process?
Let me give the court an example. If an individual engineer chooses to keep a file, this document production request was broad enough for us to search for such files. And in such instances where we found documents which had been which were on an index indicating they'd been destroyed, but were in fact in existence. We certainly didn't say, oh, we're not going to produce these because they, under the document retention policy, should have been destroyed. We produced them.
And is that also true for any documents which have been retained because of other litigation?
Correct. And there is a specific policy not to destroy documents if, in fact, there is pending litigation. But like any corporation, there comes a time in any large organization when you have to say, we don't need these documents anymore. We don't make this vehicle line anymore.
Our Rule 76A will keep you from ever having to worry about destroying any more documents.
Don't want to get into that in my last few minutes. But let me just go back and say,
Counsel, let me ask how many crash tests you have produced in the course of this lawsuit.
In July of 1990, we produced approximately 250 or 300 crash tests. In April of 1991, we produced another body of crash tests. In May of 1991, we produced even more crash tests. We've made production of hundreds of crash tests. And in fact, this inadequate production, I've now deposed Mr. Perry's expert, ready for this November 5th trial setting. The very crash test that he said couldn't form the basis of an opinion. In fact, he had nice little charts made up of the some 250 or 300 crash tests we had produced. And he said, these crash tests support my position that the vehicle was defective in this respect. These crash tests support my position that the vehicle was defective in this respect. Those are all facts that the court didn't get to hear, but that's in fact what happened.
Mr. Josephson, when you produce documents piecemeal like you've done in this case, it is very suspicious because at the first time you make a representation to the trial court, Your Honor, these are all the crash tests that we have. Later on, several months down the road, you produce more. Several months down the road, you produce more. And how are you to maintain credibility when you conduct business this way?
Let me see. I don't really think that was the problem, Your Honor. Let me explain why. The fourth request for production, we only produced six more embody crash tests after Judge Dunham's order. We produced all of the other crash tests prior to Judge Dunham's order, back in the summer of July of 1990.
So the added production in April and May is a total of six.
No, there was a fourth request for production that I mentioned to the court earlier that involved not embodies. Prior to Judge Dunham's order, the only request for production dealt with embodies. In February of 1991, the plaintiff then said, now I want all the crash tests that you have relating to non-embodies. In other words, all Chrysler passenger vehicles between 19, made between, I think it went back 20 years, Your Honor. So that what I was trying to say to the court was, we only produced six more after Judge Dunham's order that we were able to locate. Those were in-body crash tests. Then we produced the vast majority, if not all, of the tests that we produced. There may have been a few more in-bodies, but they weren't Chrysler in-body tests. But the vast majority of such tests were in conformance with the fourth request for production, which occurred, an order was entered on that in April of 1991. So that's what we were doing. In just my last minute, we would ask the court to vacate.
I've got a couple of questions for you. Under Walker against Packard, don't we have to defer as far as the factual determinations to what the trial court found in this case?
I don't necessarily agree with that, and I'll say because in the footnote in Transamerica, there is a reference to the fact that in a case-ending sanction, there should be a reasoned analysis that this court can follow in its analysis. Second, if in this case you see, in fact, a two-minute hearing at which time no basis is given for a case-ending sanction, and then you see an order that has six pages with a litany of findings, I think that's the situation where this court envisioned that without a reasoned analysis, this court has no choice but to make a determination that, in fact, a reasoned analysis was not given, that there wasn't sufficient consideration given, lesser sanctions weren't imposed, and this court then has the power. It would almost be the equivalent under those circumstances. If your requirement is that there has to be lesser sanctions applied first, it would only almost be like a no evidence point. You'd look at the record and you'd automatically see no lesser sanctions were ever imposed. Therefore, it's not a serious question of all of this evidence. There either were lesser sanctions imposed or they weren't. That's how I would analogize it.
Finally, Mr. Josephson, this really isn't a question, it's an observation. As you, I'm sure, know, before coming on the bench, I was involved in doing, among other things, products litigation for plaintiffs. I don't think I ever litigated against Chrysler or on these issues that are the basis of this suit, but on one occasion that I recall, I did consult with Mr. Perry, and I did ultimately on a non-Chrysler, non-sanctions issue refer a case to him. You can discuss it with him. It will not affect my judgment in any way in this case, but I want you to know about it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
One more question.
Yes, Your Honor.
This record that you asked to be prepared that was partially responsible for the delay in attempting a mandamus in the Court of Appeals as you were getting your record together, was that of the August hearing or the April hearing?
The August hearing.
The two-minute hearing took several weeks to prepare.
I couldn't get, and the court will see, we responded to this in the lower court because plaintiff made an argument about that, and I attached an affidavit attached to the hearing saying, and I think my colleague actually stated under oath that he called the court immediately and requested the record, and that he was told that the court was preparing a mandamus proceeding in another case, and that the court could not get to the record immediately, but the court would do so at such time as the court was able to do that. And it was not until, I believe, the end of August that we actually got this very short transcript from the court, and we put that in our brief and filed that affidavit as part of our record with this court.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court will now take a brief recess.
You guys will please rise.